You're listening to The Point. Essayist Robert Finch has a new book out, The Outer Beach, A Thousand-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so some may be surprised to learn that you, Bob Finch, are a wash ashore. Your first encounter with a Cape Cod beach was when you were about 19, and you grew up in New Jersey, not just New Jersey, urban New Jersey.
I'm a city kid. Yep, just outside Newark.
So tell us about that first visit to Cape Cod and that beach.
Ah, yes. Well, that was when I was a freshman in college in Boston, and my roommate was the son of a man who ran one of the many sailing camps that existed on Cape Cod at that time on Pleasant Bay. And so one day in the spring of, I guess it was 1962, boy, that seems ancient, doesn't it? We drove down to his house on Orleans, and he took me out to the Outer Beach, and there happened to be a nor'easter going on. And I could not have anticipated my reaction. As I describe in the essay, I just felt this incredible urge to stand there on the beach with these enormous waves coming in and conduct.
Mm-hmm. I actually wrote that. This is what you wrote. I turned full front to the ocean, raised both my arms, and began to conduct. I waved my arms out and in, up and down, in rough time to the surf's irregular rhythm.
Yeah, sounds pretty pretentious, but I mean, it was a totally unconscious response, and it took me years to sort of think about why that's the way I responded, and I guess in the end it was just encountering something so majestic, so powerful, so beautiful, that it triggers. I'd always loved music, and I'd always loved listening to music, and it triggered that response in me. Of course, I wasn't conducting anything. The ocean was conducting everything, but I sort of made myself a part of it that day. Anyway, that was my first encounter.
Yeah. And it was, in a lot of ways, it's kind of love at first sight, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that, of course, that's not unusual. People talk about that a lot. Their first experience on the Cape, and often feels like falling in love at first sight. What was different for me, I ended up spending the following two summers, working at that sailing camp. And it took me a while, several years before this idea. I know, as I said, I'm a city kid. I grew up in a place where rivers had these beautiful oil rainbow sheens on them. Mm-hmm. The bottom of the rivers were littered with glass. My marshes were always on fire. I mean, this was the kind of experience I had growing up. And it took me a while for the idea to sort of penetrate my mind, that not only could you visit a place like Cape Cod, you could actually live here. And that was a sort of a light bulb moment in my head. And I realized, oh, yeah, I could try to make a life here.
Yeah. I want to go back to the camp for a second. You've got a great story in there where you and another camp counselor take a group of boys, what were they, about eight, I think, something
yeah,
there.
Yeah, about eight kids.
Yeah, across the bay to the movies and ice cream, and this is at night, and then back again, and you hadn't even thought about, like, what danger you might
have. No, it was totally lawless. What happened was the camp had a cottage, a cabin on the Outer Beach, and supposedly we were taking the kids to spend the overnight there, but then we rigged a sail and sailed into Chatham Center and took the kids to see Dr. No, the very first James Bond movie, and took them for ice cream and then took them back and made them swear to secrecy because we would have been fired immediately.
Big trouble.
But it's funny. I know a couple of people who were the campers then, who are still on the Cape now. Now they're very respected investment bankers, and they're on the boards of various organizations. They still remember that night very vividly.
That's great. All right, let's jump to Monomoy, which, of course, is another magical place. And you write, I feel a lump in the pocket of my jeans, reach down and pull out a handful of sand. It is not ordinary Cape Cod sand, but an extremely fine variety, twice sifted, water milled, and wind distilled. There are more than 1,000 grains to the square centimeter. They roll and flow into the veins of my palm almost like water, like diamond dust. They are the sands of Monomoy. I love that, diamond dust. And for folks who have never visited Monomoy, it really is a real treat.
It's unlike any other place I know, and I refer to it somewhere as a cartographer's despair, because if you try to describe Monomoy or to draw a map of it, I mean, it has a shelf life of a few days, maybe. And as you know, just recently, just the other week, we had a new breakthrough in, I guess they call it in South Beach now. So it's the Cape is a place of constant change, and Monomoy is sort of taking that change to a higher order. It changes before your before your eyes.
Yeah, and of course the book is all about your visit to various beaches, and I'm not even going to ask you your favorite one because I don't think it's possible really to pick a favorite. But I have to say, Monomoy is probably one of the greatest places.
Oh yeah,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. In the top three anyway.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about your Nauset journals. Tell us about that.
The North Beach journals?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was probably the most time I ever spent on the outer beach. This is back in the late 70s, early 80s. I forget just right now. A neighbor of mine, I was living in Brewster, offered me the use of her cottage on the outer beach, North Beach, for a week in exchange for painting the trim on the cottages. So that's what I did, and I spent an entire week. It was about this time of year, a little later, just before Memorial Day weekend. And I, at that time, of course, there were many more beach cottages than there are now. But for that entire week, I was the only person on the outer beach. I never saw another person there. And it was, again, as is the case almost any time you go to the outer beach, you really can't anticipate what that experience is going to be. And so much depends on the specific location, on the time of year, on the weather. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I had almost a week of solid fog. Oh. I mean, as people say, Chatham is the fog factory of Cape Cod. And it played with my mind being out there alone in fog for a number of, for a week, actually. And I don't know, do you want me to
read? Yes, I would love for you to read.
Okay, this is a section of that essay that describes, I guess it's my third day out there. Goes like this. The second night I slept a troubled sleep, a sleep of too much caffeine and germinating doubts. It rained through the night, slattering on the new asphalt roof. And through the rain and wind I heard the distant, mournful calling of a piping plover on the night beach. As usual, following an initial buoyant surge of self-reliance and selfish delight at having such a place all to myself, I now began to feel insufficient. Already by Tuesday morning I found myself thinking of my daughter's irrepressible, continual engagement with life, my father's quiet, strong, indirect love. Life is always deeper on the other side of the water, it seems, though that morning the other side remained hidden in mist and swirling fog. After lunch, I took a short nap. When I awoke, a thin cloud cover had sucked the fog up into itself, and the wind had shifted to the southwest. I painted rake trim for a few hours, and then at about 4:30, walked out to the beach. The smell of the surf just coming in hit me with a rich fish and salt odor, carried along on the crashing mist of its edge by a southerly breeze. I stood and inhaled it deeply, rhythmically, timing my breath with the rush and surge of the combers. I walked south along the undulating, ivory, grist-laced slope of the beach as the white crests caught some of the red from the sinking sun. A green glass bottle thrown up on the sand glinted in the reflected light. It was corked and had a message inside, written in German, which I cannot read, accompanied by several pornographic sketches, probably thrown overboard by some bored crewman not far offshore. I recorked it and threw it back into the surf, where it floated north at about two knots. So I guess what I was trying to say is this is a place where you get side by side, you get the mundane, the extraordinary, the vulgar, and the sublime all at once.
So where did the idea for the book come from? You call it this, The Outer Beach, A 1,000-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore.
You want me to explain that subtitle?
Yeah, explain the
subtitle.
Well,
it's deliberately misleading. But I, at one point, I'm just a sort of whimsical mood, I decided to do a little rough calculation, and I figured I maybe spent half a mile every week walking the outer beach over time, and I did that for figuring 50 weeks a year, doing it for over 40 years. If you multiply all that out, you get 1,000 miles. I don't really claim anything for that. I don't claim anything for the 1,000-mile part. I mean, you know, that's really not very much over 40 years. But I was trying to express, you know, the length and the depth of the relationship that I've had with the Outer Beach. It's been a long time, yeah. And 1,000 miles is sort of a Homeric number for that. The book itself, I did it at the urging of my longtime editor Jim Mars at W.W. Norton. Unfortunately, he passed away last summer just as the book was coming to fruition, but he'd been wanting me to do this for a long time. I was sort of daunted by it because of the history of literature on the Outer Beach. I mean, everybody has to sort of confront Thoreau and his classic take of the Outer Beach, and then there's Henry Beston with The Outermost House. And then John Hay in the 1960s wrote his take on the Outer Beach called The Great Beach. And Jim said, "It's time, Bob. It's time for you to take your shot at it." So I said, okay. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Did he know that you had kept, like, you know, the North Beach journals and, you know, that the writing that you had from long ago? Did he know that that existed?
Well, in my previous books, I had published essays about the Outer Beach, but this was an attempt to sort of gather together everything
that
I had written for the last 40-some years. And first I thought it'd be easy. I'd just have to sort of put this all together. And I sort of came to realize fairly soon that it was not easy because, well, this is why I put a little epigraph at the beginning of the book to kind of express the problem of writing about a place by the Outer Beach. This is a quote from a book by Patricia Hampel, who's a wonderful essay writer. And she's actually talking about Iowa, but I thought it applied to the Outer Beach. She says, "And landscape, that vast still life, invites description, not narrative. It is lyric. It has no story. It is the beloved and asks only to be contemplated. For contemplation is, in poetic form, love. This lyric response to the world tends towards rhapsody." Well, I think that's very true, and it's especially true of the Outer Beach. It has no narrative. It there's no beginning, no middle, and no end. It's cyclical. It's always beginning. It's always ending. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm not going to try to have a narrative to it. I'm just going to put it there. But, you know, the problem is, yes, it's a lyric subject, but you can't just write lyrically for 300 pages.
Right.
You're going to, and the second quote, the epigraph I put is from John Keats. He says in one of his letters, "Description is always bad." And I kept that as a sort of
in the back of your head.
In the back of my head, don't get too lyrical for too long. So what I ended up doing, because a reader needs some kind of structure, even if it's a very artificial one, what I ended up doing was dividing the book into 14 chapters and having each chapter represent a section of the Outer Beach, moving from south to north, from Monomoy Island all the way up to the province lands and Long Point. And within each chapter, within each particular part of the Outer Beach, the essays are arranged chronologically. And I did that to sort of give the reader a sense of what it was like to be in that particular part of the Outer Beach over several decades. It is admittedly an artificial structure, but I think one that at least gives a sense of progress through time and through space.
Talk a little bit about the differences you find on your beach walks in the different seasons. You know, we have a lot of visitors who come just in the summer and they see the summer beach.
Oh, yes.
And they miss out on that winter beach.
Oh, sure.
And it changes. It's not the same.
No, as I said, your experience depends so much on the particular qualities of a particular day that you go out for a walk. And that's one reason why it's always new. You know, people ask me, do I go out to the Outer Beach with a topic in mind or I want to see something. And generally, no. Generally, I have no idea what I'm going to encounter when I go out there. There are exceptions, of course. I mean, you get a stranded whale, mm-hmm. you get a shipwreck, you get a major ocean breakthrough. And yes, I'll go out to investigate. But usually, I just want to sort of be open and respond to whatever the beach has to say to me that day. And you're right, it just changes so dramatically from day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year.
I was saying, and sometimes when you have these discoveries, you better look at them quick. I'm thinking of the Fort Hill after the storm, where the you know, ruins of an old ship, and it's gone.
Yeah. That was one of the most dramatic examples of that. That was during the great blizzard of 1978, mm-hmm. which some of us remember as probably the most powerful storm to hit the Cape in our lifetime. And I remember going up to Coast Guard Beach. This is significant. I described this in the essay about that storm. Going up to Coast Guard Beach with hundreds of other people. And if you weren't there then, you have no idea what existed at Coast Guard Beach in East Ham at that time. The National Seashore had a bathhouse right down on the beach. It had a 600-car paved parking lot just below the old Coast Guard station. And we went up there and watched these enormous waves just battering to pieces this brick bathhouse. And what struck me was that every time the wave hit the bathhouse, everybody cheered.
Yeah. We're talking with Robert Finch about his book, The Outer Beach, A 1,000-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Robert Finch about his book, The Outer Beach, A 1,000-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. So in an essay titled An Old Friend Visits, you write about an acquaintance visiting from the Berkshires whose life has gone awry. And you and he go for a walk on Nauset Beach to talk. And you write towards the end of the essay, "If I were to live by aesthetics alone, I would probably live where he does, among mountains, for I actually prefer them to the low grandeur of the sea. But the sea tells me more about myself as the hills do him. And so that is why each of us chooses to live where we do."
Hmm. Yeah. I think that's true, although it has its limits. But I think that where we live, if we live in a place over time, it shapes our perception of the world. And of course, the most obvious quality here on the Cape, and especially Outer Beach, is change. Mm-hmm. I've said this many times in many essays, that the beach teaches you how to live with change. And in the end, you know, what I had to say to him, or what the beach had to say to him, didn't really register, because he was not from that place. He was from the hills of Vermont and the Berkshires. And those places provide their own metaphors for living.
Also in the section about Nauset Beach, you described the creep of the ocean towards seaside cottages. You wrote an essay in 1975, "The encroachment of the sea is not new, yet we still choose to get as close as we can."
Mm-hmm.
It's still true today.
It is. And one of the themes in the book, or repeated topics, is how people respond to the destruction that takes place on the Outer Beach, the erosion, mm-hmm. Particularly people who own property. And I guess, and this has always been true for what I write about, I'm just as interested in human behavior and human nature as I am in wild nature. And it's where the two interact that I find the most fertile material to write about, and probably no more than in the cases of people who own oceanfront property and have to face directly that loss. Mm. And how people respond to it, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah. I don't know how much of your life you've lived away from the sea, but talk about times when you've lived or been away from the sea and how that experience differs from when you're living near the ocean.
You mean off Cape?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I grew up as a city kid living in New Jersey for my first 12 years, and we hardly ever went to the ocean, although we weren't that far from it. I think my parents' preference was the lakes. Mm-hmm. Actually, New Jersey has some wonderful, beautiful lakes in the northwestern part, and that's where we went to. And that was my That's where I imprinted on water, was in the lakes. And I think, in a way, that's still my favorite part of the Cape, are the ponds. They're not written at all about in this book. But I think we all imprint on what we experience when we're young. And that lake experience has stayed with me over time. The great thing about the Cape is you get both.
Yeah.
Fresh water and salt water.
You have a piece about stopping by Marconi Beach after dinner out and before heading to the movies, and you write, "The earth, I think, closes on itself when we do not give it our full attention. When, for instance, we're still savoring a big meal and looking forward to mindless entertainment, the beach refuses to be a preview. Nature does not offer itself to one who would slip in between trivial events, between gluttony and lust. It will not hold counsel with us when we are already going someplace else as we arrive."
Yeah, well, that essay was kind of a confession. I mean, I'm as guilty as this as anybody. Sometimes we think we can just zip down to the beach and get a memorable experience. And the beach, no, the beach requires you a little more of you than that. And it's a lesson worth keeping in mind. You have to give yourself completely as you can to a place like the beach in order for it to speak to you.
In an era when people are always busy and when we're not busy, we're distracted by technology, do we run the risk of losing our connection with nature and eventually an understanding or an appreciation of nature?
Oh, big questions. I don't want to sound sententious.
Well, I'm just even thinking, too, when this younger generation, they a lot of times experience it through, television or some, they're not actually out experiencing it, with nature.
Sure, it's true. And I think one of the results of that is, and, I grew up, I was the first generation of kids to grow up on TV. There weren't a lot of nature films at that time. But I do think one of the problems with being introduced to nature through technologically filtered devices is it changes your expectations. You watch a nature show, very good NOVA shows and other PBS shows. They're very good. They're informative. They can be quite beautiful. But they're edited. Mm-hmm. They're shaped. They're made to be a narrative. And I think often that's what we grow up with. We go out to nature expecting it to be like that, expecting to have a ready-made story that we can just experience as we wish. Probably the most extreme example of that, and this will take us far away from Cape Cod, back in the early 1980s when I was doing some travel pieces, I was sent to Kenya to go on a safari, which was a wonderful experience, actually. But the night before, we stayed in one of these palatial hotels up in the Aberdare Mountains, and we were told that Prince Charles and Diana had just recently stayed there. Anyway, in these rooms, there were a set of lighted buttons, okay? And as you sat in your room, if a button came on, if it was a red button, that meant there was a rhinoceros, outside, and you could run down and see the rhinoceros, or a yellow button, and that was a giraffe, and you could run out and see the giraffe. And this was, for a lot of people, the core of their experience of nature, on schedule.
Right.
So I think we lose some of the ability to be patient, the ability to have an experience that means nothing. But I don't know. I think we all, since somebody first put on their first pair of glasses, we were looking at things through a artificial lens. And I'm not about to say that the younger generation won't find a way to interact with nature in a compelling way. It's just going to be different.
It's going to be different, yeah. So you've compiled these essays from over 40 years of writing, and
right.
as you put this together, were there things, you go back and look and go, oh, I had forgotten about that. Were there things that kind of stood out to you as you were putting this together that make an imprint on you now?
Things that stood out as I was putting
as you were putting together, were there anything in particular that stood out as you were, compiling all this that maybe you'd forgotten about or that kind of linger in your mind still?
Yeah. Boy, you know, it took me 6 years to put this together.
That's a lot of reflecting.
Right, and at first I had to, you know, I keep all of my notes in longhand in a journal, and I'm a terrible typist. So the first thing I had to do was somehow get them on the computer, and that's when I discovered the voice-to-text programs, which were fun to do. So yeah, there were things I'd forgotten that had happened. I guess there's a chapter, it's one of the longest chapters in the book, and it was an experiment, and I don't know how it works. Maybe you can tell me if it worked for you. Before I moved to Wellfleet, I've lived in Wellfleet now for over 20 years. One of my favorite places to go is out at Newcomb Hollow, where just south of the parking lot, there is a rather massive outcrop of blue clay. And this goes towards something you said earlier. It's a constantly changing apparition, very different from the sand and the dunes, very dramatic. And I was surprised at how much I had written about that one area. And I just decided I'm not even going to try to put a form on this. I'm just going to put down all the impressions I've had of that particular place over 40 years. The thing that reminded